This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, and my guest today is the legendary actor and director Andy Serkis, who has played everyone from Gollum to punk icon Ian Dury to King Kong to the Marvel villain Ulysses Klaw. His latest project is an animated version of George Orwell's Animal Farm, which he directed and is out on May 1st from Angel Studios. Andy Serkis, thanks for talking to Reason.
Very, very nice to see you. How you doing?
All right. So let's talk about Animal Farm, which features voices of people like actors like Seth Rogen, Woody Harrelson, Glenn Close. What drew you to the material?
I read the book when I was about, must have been about 10 or 11 years old, on the bus to school. And it was one of those books that, you know, when you get to that age and you start reading things that you know have underlying themes, but you don't really fully understand what are being driven at. But I just knew that it had an innocence about it. And yet I kind of could feel that there was like a world that was underneath it. And that was, it was one of those books that just never left me. And I read it again in years to come, you know, at various different points in my life.
It's one of those books too, where, you know, especially if you're a little bit precocious, it's an animal book. It's a funny animal talking book. And then you realize this is one of the darkest stories, you know, that it was written in the 20th century, right?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, when I began to uncover it and realize that each specific animal was associated with a historical figure, obviously surrounding the Russian Revolution and the failure of the communist era and the rise to authoritarianism and Stalinism. So it was I mean, as I say, it was a story that never left me. It was when I started to really think about wanting to be a director, that came about as one of the first things I wanted to do, actually, many years ago. And I realized that there hadn't been an adaptation of it since there was a 1954 animation and then a 1990 sort of animatronic version. But it seemed like it hadn't been touched for many years, and that we were living in a world that could do with another dose of it, really.
Yeah, and that 54 adaptation or that version is fascinating because it was actually underwritten by the CIA during the early years of the Cold War. So, and it has a different ending, etc. Now, this is an adaptation and an updating of it. So obviously, it's not about communism. And in Animal Farm, Napoleon, the lead pig, you know, the most equal of all the equal pigs is Stalin. How does it work here? Because the system that you're kind of critiquing is not socialism, right, or international communism. Where do you go with that?
No, we felt that when we started working on it, and we talked to the Orwell estate a lot about it. If Orwell were writing that story now, what would his targets be? And, you know, he was someone who reviled authoritarianism on a grander level. So, I mean, that at that particular time, obviously, he was aiming at a particular regime. But if he was writing Animal Farm right now, what would be his targets? A lot of the themes are exactly the same. It's just the different management systems around the world that use authoritarianism and dictatorship to survive. Obviously, are thriving, and this is not a stab at any one leader in terms of the allegory. It's not, we're not saying this is this political leader, but it's having a go at all of the framework of what controls us and what is authoritarian around the world, like, you know, the misuse of information, fake news, all of those things which are a themes in the book, the corruption of power. And so it was looking really looking at that in a modern context for a young audience, which is crucial. It was written as an allegory for young children to read, as I read it when I was that age, because...
I was going to say, it obviously the Napoleon character who's, you know, and I'm not going to give any spoilers to your version of it, which, you know, again, it's an adaptation. It's not a direct replication of the novel. But Napoleon, who becomes, you know, the pig in charge of Animal Farm, part of it is just that when you have power, you want more power. right? Or you start to exercise more power and start to critique it. Then there is the overlay of, you know, the intersection or the relationship between the farm that the animals are running and then a big department store or a corporation. Are you drawing an equivalence between corporate power and, you know, totalitarianism, or where is that line being drawn?
We're drawing a parallel between misuse of power across all aspects of modern life. So whether it's in the office space, whether it's in as part of a big corporation, whether it's individuals bullying, it's about what happens when someone, and it's also about, you know, governments who stop listening to the people who have put them in power. So it's not kind of what, it's not a one to one. It's sort of it's looking at the abuse of power and the manipulation of, you know, of an innocent young mind having to, who begins to follow this creed, if you like, that he thinks is meant to be good for all, but actually ends up being only good for the elite. And that's really, you know, so we invented a character, which actually is taken from later on in the book, when there's a scene a long way into the story where the young piglets of the next generation, who are now the elite, are separate from the rest of the animals, and they can barely remember the rebellion when all of the animals rebelled together. And so I decided to take the notion of this: what if you had a young piglet and see it through the eyes of this young innocent piglet? Backtrack, put him into the story where all animals are equal, and then have him be sort of taken on this journey, a sort of journey, putting him in the driving seat, putting our young audience in the seat, the moral maze of what happens if you have two different people telling you two different things. Someone is saying, you know, Snowball, the character of Snowball, we're doing this all together. And Napoleon, who is charismatic, funny, witty, and leading,
gaseous, flatulent.
Flatulent, right. Exactly. Yes. You know, but he leads him in a different direction, and he succumbs to that because he believes that Napoleon is right, because all leaders who are, you know, witty, charismatic, and flatulent.
I'm curious, I guess two questions. Like, do you have a politics? You know, and if so, what is that? And then also, you know, when you look at, you know, 100 years ago, roughly, when, or maybe not quite 100 years ago, but 80 years ago, you know, when Orwell was writing, 70, 80 years ago, are we in a better place? I mean, there's no question there's a lot of problems in the world, and authoritarianism seems to be on the rise in various places. But, you know, compared to, you know, the late 40s, you know, are we in a better place? And if so, you know, what accounts for that?
I don't necessarily think we are in a better place. And part of this story is about history repeating itself. And why is it that we always make the same mistakes? And even though we do, we mustn't stop trying to rectify those mistakes. And I think that's really at the core of our version, that that there is no answer. And we will probably keep repeating things, but you still have to keep trying to understand. And it really is about learning to listen. And I think a lot of this is, one of the things about making this version, as I say, it was for young people to sit in a room with their parents and grandparents, who have probably got all different viewpoints about the world, and actually really start to investigate through a debate. It was to cause a debate, but it's a family film, so that will hopefully inspire debate between cross generations.
Hey, Reason Interview listeners. Do you know a student looking for a serious intellectual experience that strengthens the foundations of a free society? Reliance College invites students ages 16 to 24 to the 2026 Great Connection Seminar in Chicago from July 25th to August 1st. This year's theme, Reason and Love, explores the ideas that shape character, choice, and human flourishing. Students engage directly with thinkers like Aristotle, Ayn Rand, and Alexis de Tocqueville in small dynamic discussion groups where every claim requires evidence and reasoning. They don't sit through lectures, they practice thinking for themselves. Outside the seminar room, students explore Chicago's cultural landmarks, analyze art firsthand, experience live improv comedy, and build friendships rooted in shared intellectual ambition. Parents, if you want your student equipped to reason independently, speak confidently, and contribute meaningfully to a free society, this program was built for them. Registration is just $900, and that includes room for the full week with scholarships available. Visit reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. That's reliancecollege.org/reason. The, you know, let's talk about some of your signature roles. And, I want to ask if there is a common line in them, you know, and obviously, maybe most famously, I mean, it's hard to say. And you, I mean, it's got to be kind of great for you to have been part of not just, you know, like franchises that have done well or, you know, but have that have done spectacularly well and kind of paint the imagination of contemporary, you know, film. So, I mean, you were Gollum in the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit movies. We'll come to Ian Dury in a little bit, King Kong in a remake of that. And then in a couple of Marvel movies, you're this horrible arms dealer, you know, who's just all kinds of evil. You know, is there, you know, is Gollum kind of the personification of somebody who gets a little bit of power and then wants more, or gets corrupted by the possibility of power? Is that the shadow self that you're chasing in many of these roles?
Yeah, I think what I've always tried to do as an actor is, you know, I think the job of the actor or the storyteller, let's say, is to try and broaden the audience's perspective and give and by taking the notion of evil and sort of saying, if you sort of enter into this from a viewpoint of, well, evil doesn't exist per se, but because it's all about conditioning and the conditioning that we all grow up in, you know, so I obviously, if you're an actor inside the head of a character, you have to believe that there's a morality that character believes in. So every character I've played, I've wanted to examine that. And therefore it takes you as a person to be, you sort of have to be empathetic to perhaps places you don't necessarily want to go. And that is the challenge of acting, and you can't deny that because you have to believe that that character sees the world in his, or you know, his perspective, from his perspective, as the right view. So that's, and by doing that, I think you hopefully leave the audience at the end. I'm not saying that we human, I am saying that humanize monsters to a certain extent in order to be able to understand them and hopefully learn from them.
Do you feel, I mean, I guess to go back to that question of, you know, but you're not confident that, you know, 100 years on from World War II and, you know, 30 years or so after the collapse of communism, we're not in a fundamentally better place where, you know, we understand evil a little bit better, or, you know, the stakes are a little bit clearer, or people have more room to breathe and live the way that they want?
I mean, if you look around the world at the moment and the way we're living, it doesn't seem that way. You know, it's like maybe there is, I mean, there has been a little ground gained in respect and understanding other and not, you know, I don't think we live perhaps in a sort of, I mean, you know, at that time of the British Empire, for instance, was still a huge, there was a shadow of the British Empire at that time, which seemed to control much of the world. And that's what Orwell was rebelling against to a certain extent. I mean, he's such an interesting man because he grew up in sort of a sort of lower middle class, sort of upper middle class rather, went to a very posh British school, then went and joined as part of the British Empire, the Burmese police force, witnessed brutality, became a socialist, that fought in the Spanish Civil War against communists and the fascist dictatorship. You know, he was searching for what he, you know, these are historically what was fueling his books like Animal Farm and 1984. So he's also interestingly, he's sort of claimed by both left and right, by left and right.
In collections like Homage to Catalonia, where he, you know, about the Spanish Civil War, which was this great moment where there was a moment when the socialists or the you know, gained control, and they exhibited the same problems that the fascists were showing. And, you know, he got called out for saying that at the time, because you were supposed to pick a side and not be independent.
That's right. That's right. So I think do we listen to each other more now? I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, we've got the facility to, with social media, the social media is such a kind of egalitarian mouthpiece that everyone can share, and everyone can be a critic. Everyone can have a go. You can be nasty or you can be generous publicly, as we've seen. So I think that is, I mean, I'd be fascinated if Orwell was sitting down right now at this second and sat down to write Animal Farm as an allegory of using innocent farm animals as a Trojan horse to examine what is going on in the world right now. I think he would be talking about the fact that we gain a little, but then we fall back into these terrible.
But is there a categorical difference, say, between what's going on in Russia under Putin or China under Xi? And even, you know, I mean, we're talking a few days after Viktor Orban, who had become increasingly autocratic in Hungary, you know, but after 16 years, lost an election badly and stepped down. Like, you know, are conditions in places like England and the U.S. or New Zealand or, you know, Japan, you know, they seem to be fundamentally different and better than places like Russia and China?
I think they have the historical legacies of long-term oppression, you know, which I think we don't have. We've had, you know, democracy as a system of belief is perhaps a little better, but it's still can fall prey to, you know, it can still fall prey to the abuse of power. That's the thing. And I think, again, going back to the core of what our film's about is when certain, you know, leaders or factions or belief systems stop listening to the majority and actually don't care about the majority anymore, because it becomes about self-preservation. And that is really what I think we're getting at. I mean, in our film, I mean, obviously, you know, in Animal Farm, there is no third act really, but we decided that we don't want to leave the audience in especially a young audience without hope. And so there is, we do have, and it's, so it's, so, I mean, at the end of the book in Animal Farm, the animals outside of the window gather around to look through, and they see pigs talking to humans, and they're indecipherable who is who, you know, they from man to pig and pig to man, and nobody can tell the difference. We go past that. We go past that in a way that young Lucky, the piglet who once the scale falls from his eyes and he realizes he's terribly made the wrong decision to back Napoleon, goes back to his animals and he answers that question to himself: are you a pig or are you an animal? Are you part of the wider group? And from then it's like we do depart the book, but we wanted to leave particularly young audience with a sense of I can make a difference next time round, because they will inherit the earth. You know, our kids are going
to, whether they want to or not, right? And the debt. I want to talk about the way technology, you know, works to either, or, you know, there's an argument it works to enhance or to hamper creativity. And I think your career in many ways is, you know, is an incredible, great way to kind of examine that question. But first, Ian Dury. Ian Dury is probably better known in England or in the UK than he is in America, but he was an early punk. He had been crippled as a child from polio. He had two big hits or biggish hits in America, which were Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick and Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, which is the name of the movie in which you play him. What drew you to Ian Dury, and what's the enduring legacy of Ian Dury, particularly for people in the 21st century who may have never heard of him or listened to one of his songs, although they should?
Absolutely should. He was, I mean, really, when you think about Ian Dury, he was a proto-punk. He began, he sort of inadvertently was part of the beginning of the punk movement before the Sex Pistols. Yeah. And in fact, Johnny Rotten copied his gait and Lear and the way he led
And he stuttered. I mean, he stutter-stepped because he was physically... Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The whole of just, left hand side was,
yeah.
He had a withered arm and a withered left leg. Mm-hmm. He had a caliper, and he literally, but the right hand side of his body was like a Tyrannosaurus Rex. I mean, he was like so strong. so he was a real force. He was a poet. There's a song called Reason to Be Cheerful, which is like an early form of rap.
Reasons to Be Cheerful. Part three, right? Is it or part? Yeah. So there we go. Yes.
He goes something like somebody holly the working folly, good golly Miss Molly and goats.
Yep.
Hammersmith Pally, the Bolshoi Bally, jump back in the alley and nanny goats. You know, it's like he's a poet. He's kind of like a beat poet. But also he was this incredibly forceful persona on stage, and I had the luck to actually see him on stage, but I also had the luck to work with him very briefly when he was going to be writing music for a play that I was working on. And he sums up for me a kind of a really idiosyncratic individual spirit, and a kind of, again, he was fighting against the system, against being classed disabled, and rebelling against that and saying, I don't think of myself as disabled, this is who I am, and this is, you know, he was a gigantic force
it's fascinating to think about punk as this explosion of, you know, first of anger, obviously people remember that, and of a system, you know, with the British Empire and just kind of decorum is really not offering, as you know, Johnny Rotten saying, there's no future and England's burning, but, you know, individuals, all of whom were very different, and Ian Dury and, you know, Elvis Costello and the Sex Pistols and the Buzzcocks all kind of, you know, hung out together. They hated each other. They were rivals, but that just explosion of individualism. I mean, I guess I go back to this question because we're about the same age, you know, early 60s. And like, when I think of the world, and this is in America, but I think it's analogous, you know, the world that my parents grew up in, you know, which was, you know, in the back rear view mirror was the Depression and World War II. You know, like my childhood growing up in the 70s were pretty shitty in America, but it was like pretty good for me. And it's so much better now. Isn't England fundamentally better than it was in the 70s, much less the 40s?
Look, I mean, you know, Britain went through, well, the 70s, yeah, it was probably getting to be a bit of a better place in the 70s, but then we had, you know, the arrival of a political leader who I can't even, well, I won't mention, but I think we'll know who it is.
Are you an anti-Thatcherite? I mean, are you, you're like,
I would say that I'm probably leaning that way. Yeah, just ever so slightly.
Yeah. Okay.
No, totally.
When she died, it was fascinating. A couple of punks, including people like Johnny Rotten, were like, you know, in a weird way, Thatcher, who kind of came before the punk movement really became political, she was kind of punk because she was a woman. She was what passed for lower, upper middle class or whatever in England, because she was a shopkeeper's daughter.
Yeah.
So in a way, she was part of the same process, the exhaustion of the British Empire and this revival into something different.
That's true. But then she also did say there is no such thing as society, you know, became a mantra. And this is what I mean about power. And this is mm-hmm. when you have power and you no longer have people telling you when you're in power that you're wrong or questioning it, or you stop listening because you think your way is the only way. It's like in the book, Boxer, who represents the sort of the working class, Boxer's mm-hmm. a shire horse, for those who don't know the story.
Right.
Who's an indefatigable kind of worker, and you know he's not the most intelligent, but he's an emotionally intelligent beast, but he is completely in the thrall of a leader who he always says Napoleon is always right. Napoleon is right, blindly following leadership. So which brings about, you know, a sort of, without ruining the story, a tragic end to him. You know, I hear what you're saying about a character like that. You know, she was the first woman.
Thatcher got, I mean, when she got voted out, or when her party lost, you know, she stepped down, right? So, I mean, there was a case of democracy working. And it is always kind of fascinating, even transformative figures like her, who seem like, okay, she's going to be the prime minister forever. And then she wasn't. And you know, things went on. You were, and I'm forgetting the name of it. You, in researching this, you were in a play that was about Thatcher and the head of the Argentine military junta that clashed over the Falklands War. And that's thought that was kind of interesting because, you know what, I think the Falklands War was a ridiculous exercise in jingoism. It obviously saved Thatcher's ass. I mean, she was doing poorly. That, and people like Christopher Hitchens in his autobiography talked about how even he was like, oh yeah, I'm a Thatcherite as long as we're fighting Argentina. But it's interesting that the military junta in Argentina, because they lost the Falklands War, they were wiped out of power.
When leaders, you know, get into trouble, what do? You start a war in another country, and suddenly everything gets together.
Well, we have some of that going on right now, right? I mean, all sorts of people. I think so. Yeah. Let's talk about technology, because you know, one of you obviously have done a ton of, you know, I don't want this to sound dismissive, but straight acting. You've done a ton of stage. You've done a lot of movies and television, you know, where you're acting, you know, with maybe minimal makeup, but then you also do the motion capture stuff. And I know, particularly for the Gollum sequence or in a couple of those movies, some people were saying, like, you should have been nominated for an Academy Award because this is as much acting as, you know, anything like John Hurt in The Elephant Man or something where he was, you know, invisible under lots of prosthetics and things like that. How do you feel about the technology of the type of acting that you have particularly excelled in? And, you know, a lot of artists are very romantic with a capital R, and they are like, you know, technology gets in the way. Special effects destroy movies. CGI is destroying movies. You've worked with people like Peter Jackson, you know, who is, you know, is, I mean, like, how do you make sense of this? Is technology obviously a good thing in creative pursuits, and should we have a better attitude towards it?
Well, we would never have had the film camera or a way of projecting movies if people hadn't used technology to take stories to the masses, you know? So yeah, I fully believe that technology needs to be
so hard. It's always like, you know, well, we can have movies, but no special effects, right? I mean, it's this performative contradiction of like, okay, that's enough, you know? We can have skateboards, but not cars or something. Yeah, exactly.
And it's the same as flight. You know, somebody invented, you know, the Wright brothers got a plane up in the air in 1905, but in 1914, those planes were being used to bomb soldiers, you know. So it's all about, creatives. And we know that creatives inspire, you know, sci-fi. I mean, sci-fi inspires what happens in the future. It's storytellers, people I think may underestimate, and actually, you know, they're prescient. Storytellers have been for thousands of years incredibly prescient, and I think that technology is, it's all about letting the genie out of the bottle and then not letting it dominate you and you being able to use it. So obviously the big one at the moment is AI. And when I was working on the early Lord of the Rings films and the progression of performance capture or motion capture, as it was called, has become performance capture because it's the entire performance that's captured. You know, it's a team effort, but then filmmaking is a team effort. But just go back to the origins of your question. You know, the actor is on set acting the role and has read the script and worked through that character's arc from page 1 to 120. And you're the author of the role using performance capture. And which you are if you're wearing prosthetic makeup, which has taken an enormous team of people to create a manifestation on a look of that character. But and the same is with performance capture. The difference is that it's very hard to explain simplistically the translation from say my face playing Caesar, which has to be retargeted. Mm-hmm. Face of a chimpanzee rather than the old-fashioned original Planet of the Apes where they were wearing prosthetic makeup, which you couldn't really see the facial expressions of the actor. Right. Whereas the retargeting, as we would say, from the actor's performance to the digital mask of Caesar, you know, does require an intermediate stage with other CG artists. But that for me is like the actor is authoring the role, and then you have other artists who are bringing that and manifesting it. So one can't live without the other. So that's, I think, going back to the original question, you know, about
have your kids seen you in some of these roles? I mean, like, what, you know, have they seen you as Gollum? Have they seen you as King Kong? Oh, have they seen you as Caesar, the leader of the, you know, the revolting planet of apes and the planet of the apes? How do they make sense of it? Or
because actually, I mean, the great thing is it's a wonderful spectator sport. You can sit and watch on a monitor in real time. You can see the actor playing the role. And then you can see on another monitor, you can see the CG character moving in complete unison with what the actor's doing. All my kids have watched that from, you know, from the year of, you know, 2 or 3 years old. So it's interesting because, you know, actors now who come out of drama schools, there was about 10, 15 years ago, if you'd said, would you like to be in a video game? Most actors would go, no, I'm an actor, you know, but now everyone wants to be in video games. They are the new way of communicating a story, or they're, you know, and performance really lives within those games now.
I guess let's end with a final return to Animal Farm. You've said this story isn't just a story for entertainment. It's a reminder that democracy, freedom, and integrity are fragile and must be watched over. What are your biggest concerns? And I'll say, you know, I'm a small L libertarian in America, and, you know, the kind of transposition of Orwell's allegory about, you know, not just communism, but the Soviet Union under Stalin to a kind of contemporary world, I am left wondering, like, is consumerism so bad? Is Jeff Bezos a lighter form of Stalinism? Like, I don't think so. I'm not saying you are saying something like that, but what is the big fear here? Because, you know, where kind of in a place like America is the authoritarianism that you're most worried about?
I think it's about, as I say, I think it's about a place where you're no longer listened to. And that is a dangerous place. And when you other, you know, certain elements of society, and when you victimize and bully and discriminate against any kind of portion of society that doesn't fit in with your own worldview, then you are an oppressor. And I'll say something at the end of our film. There's a quote, which is, this film is dedicated to all those who are oppressed, for your time will come, and to those who oppress, for your time will certainly come to an end. And that is kind of what this film's about. It's about saying we have to keep trying. We just have to keep trying.
Right.
So whether it's in the office, if someone's being bullied, if it's someone who's being discriminated against racially, if it's whatever it is, we have to sit up and take notice. We can't just hide behind and rant into our phones, you know, and hope that someone's going to listen. We have to talk. We have to communicate.
And as you were saying about social media, that our phones, we're in an interesting time because everybody can participate. But oftentimes people, you know, they feel anonymous, and that, you know, they start screaming rather than talking.
Well, yeah. I mean, when we put the first trailer out of this film, people were, I mean, there was an insane amount of hits, like 10 million hits or more.
Yeah.
And I'm really hating it, saying Orwell would be rolling in his grave, or, you know, Andy Serkis turns Orwell into fart jokes, or, you know, and it's like, you've not seen the film yet. Go and see the film. Right. Then talk about it.
That would ruin it. I mean, once you, you know, you never have to see something or read something before you can comment it. But the new movie is Animal Farm. The director and our guest today is Andy Serkis. This has been The Reason Interview. Thanks for watching. Andy, thanks so much for talking to me today.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much.